The New York Times ran a really interesting piece yesterday that I don't think got enough attention. It was about something that might sound a little technical and mundane, and that is the papers of the Supreme Court, of the Supreme Court justices. Obviously, they do a fair amount of work. I'm not going to say a lot of work. They should do much more. They do a fair amount of work. They write about 60 opinions and concurrences and dissents every year, in addition to shorter orders and the like. And so much of that work involves lots of negotiation behind the scenes, memos and letters to each other, communications with their clerks, communications with people outside of the court. And those papers, all of that accumulated information, all of that accumulated correspondence, all of that accumulated deliberation, those papers belong to the justices. They are the personal artifacts of the justices themselves. Now, you might hear that and say, I don't see what the big deal. The big deal is that the justices are not just private citizens. They are employees of the United States government who hold offices under the Constitution. If you are in the executive branch, the papers you produce as a member of the executive branch, as a member of the White House, are subject to presidential records laws. This was the whole thing with Donald Trump and the papers he kept in Mar-a-Lago. And this is why, according to most reports, people like Stephen Miller do all of their deliberations and scheming face-to-face. Because if you write it down and then you destroy those papers, that's a crime. And if you're in the business of committing crimes, you don't really want to be writing things down.
Nigga, is you taking notes on a criminal fucking conspiracy? What the fuck is you thinking, man?
But the Supreme Court is not governed by any set of records laws. And so justices can essentially do whatever they want with their papers. As the piece notes, Thurgood Marshall, the first black justice of the Supreme Court, the man who argued Brown v. Board, a famous and important justice, gave his papers to the National Archives and said that the archives could release them at their discretion. And the chief justice at the time, William Rehnquist, was outraged by this. He was very angry about it because the justices value secrecy quite a bit. They don't want people to know their deliberations, at least until long after they're dead. And that's often what happens. We often do not get their papers until long after they're dead. That will likely be the case for the current justices, who will probably not release their papers until long after they're gone. I will be an old man before most of these papers are available for public use and public viewing. The justices feel that their independence requires this, and I'd say they also feel entitled to it. It's a privilege of theirs to be able to hide away their correspondence and thoughts and deliberations from the broad public. So much of the conversation around Supreme Court reform is how to deal with recent rulings like Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health and Bruin v. New York and Louisiana v. Calais, these rulings that have done, I think, a tremendous damage to Americans' individual rights and have created chaos in the American legal system and in American society. Reform is also dealing with questions of political corruption among the justices and the simple fact that the justices seem to be highly politicized but not particularly responsive to the public at large. And those are all, I think, legitimate reasons to want to reform the Supreme Court. Those are some of my reasons for wanting to reform the Supreme Court. And it's why some of the proposals for reform include term limits for justices, a strict code of ethics for the justices, and tighter regulation of the shadow docket to prevent the justices from making decisions without having to explain themselves. But as we think about Supreme Court reform, we ought to think about larger goals as well, not just fundamental transformation of the institution, but thinking about the purpose we want the institution to serve. Thinking about the relationship we want the institution to have to the rest of the political system. One of the problems and challenges right now is that the court and the justices themselves don't quite see themselves as part of the larger political system. They see themselves as floating above it, constitutional umpires, not so much members and participants in a constitutional game on equal standing with the president and with the Congress and with the public. But that's what they are. And I think one goal for Supreme Court reform should be to show and remind the justices that, in fact, they are part of the political system. They exist under the Constitution, and they don't get any special entitlements because they wear black robes. And although their records and transparency seems relatively minor in the scheme of things, I think it's actually emblematic of the central problem, that these people do not feel any responsibility or obligation to the public at large. They view themselves as engaged in high-level legal theorizing and high-level legal reasoning, in crafting and implementing their bespoke theories of executive power or separation of powers or what have you. But in my view, that's not their job. Their job is to be the court of last resort for cases and controversies, for the biggest cases and controversies, where there isn't a clear answer and where both sides probably have a good point here or there. Their job is to balance things, to find something that's acceptable and that allows the society to move on with a sense of fairness. Occasionally, that might mean curtailing an aggressive arrogation of the people's constitutional rights. But more often than not, it involves balancing competing interests. Not looking for ways, looking for excuses to implement broad new doctrines, to overturn decades of precedent, because they're captured and enamored of, again, these theories that have no application in the real world, that have never been tried in the real world, and that when they apply them, such as the history and tradition test in Bruin, it produces legal chaos. Here, as I like to remind people, the Constitution really doesn't say that much about the Supreme Court. I will show you. Grabbing my pocket Constitution here. Got it from the Library of Congress, I think. National Archives? Where did they get this? I don't remember. Anyway, let's turn to Article 3. The judicial power of the United States shall be invested in one Supreme Court and in such inferior courts as the Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. There's not much more other than that. It tells us what the original jurisdiction of the court is. It tells us that the Congress can regulate everything about the court as it relates to its appellate jurisdiction, which is most of what the court does. I bring this up because so much about the court is simply subject to ordinary law, not constitutional amendments, not executive orders, ordinary law. Congress can just pass a bill like they'd pass a bill to do anything else, to change all manner of things about the court. Obviously its size, but also where it sits, how it hears its cases, which cases it hears, its method for choosing cases. Right now, the court has broad discretion to choose its cases, which is something that began in the early 20th century. It's relatively recent. The shadow docket or the emergency docket is a recent development. Congress can regulate it. Congress can say you can no longer do this, or that these are the criteria for emergency decisions, or that any emergency decision must have a full written explanation for it, and so on and so forth. Congress can strip the court of jurisdiction to hear particular kinds of cases. Congress, I think, can impose ethics rules, binding ones. And Congress can mandate that the court provide its papers in an organized and timely manner after justices retire. I understand that justices retire and there might still be live cases and the like. And so it doesn't have to be an immediate thing. You can wait 5 years, 10 years. But after a set point, the papers are released to the public because they belong to the public. Because the Supreme Court is not actually a guardian council of legal wizards. It's 9 people, hopefully 13 or 15 soon, who are relatively politically well-connected, have some judicial experience, have some other legal experience, and are considered among their partisan peers to be well-suited to sit on the nation's top court. Some of these people may think that they are legal geniuses. I'm looking at Neil Gorsuch in particular. But there are stronger legal minds in the country, whether sitting in the bench or in legal academia. The court represents people who are smart enough and politically well-connected. But their obligation, first and foremost, is to the country, is to the people, is to the Constitution, which gives them their authority, and that Constitution is an instantiation of the people's sovereignty, of the people's will. And so again, as we think about court reform, at the top of our priorities ought to be, how do we cut this institution back down to size? How do we remind these people that they don't work for themselves or their buddies in the Federalist Society or whatever, that their first job is to the Constitution and to the people of the United States? And if they can't do that, then they shouldn't be there in the first place. As always, let me know what you think. Thank you for watching. And I'll see you next time.